Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Cherokee author Annette Sanuk Clapsaddle invites readers back to 1942 and the time of World War II. Even As We Breathe brings readers to Grove Park Inn in North Carolina, where foreign diplomats create a lot of intrigue for the author's main character, who is Cherokee and takes on a job as a groundskeeper at the inn. We'll hear more about the dynamic storyline from the author today on our February Book of the Month. We go live right after National Native News. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native women elected officials are among those paying attention to the confirmation hearing of Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior. Christina Haswood, a Kansas State representative, resonates with Haaland and says it's important for Native people to hold space and have a voice.
The system has oppressed us for so long, has created genocide, and, you know, has chose corporate over the betterment of our land. It's really empowering to see someone who carries our values and indigenous values in a very important position, a historical position, to bring these voices to the table that often felt like our voices were silenced and not supported.
Haaland often talks about her Pueblo way of life and struggles she's faced as a single mother. As a congresswoman from New Mexico, Haaland's been a strong advocate for indigenous and environmental issues. North Dakota State Representative Ruth Buffalo says, if confirmed, she believes Haaland will continue to advocate for Native people.
I see her going to the communities and listening. I see her as being a really down-to-earth people person, and so I know that she's going to hit the ground running and that she's really going to go to the communities who are being impacted by different policies at this very moment, and she's going to go there and listen. That's what I see happening.
Haaland testified Tuesday at her confirmation hearing, which included being grilled by pro-fossil fuel senators. Haaland says as secretary, she'll push forward President Biden's agenda and work to find balance on energy and climate issues. Those types of conversations mirror what Haswood says she has with lawmakers in Kansas and believes Haaland will listen to all sides.
When I saw that here at home, there was a lot of anger coming from, you know, the side that really wants to invest in these fossil fuels. I think we need to move forward of continuing this conversation of constantly educating one another and, okay, how can we, you know, use both of our ideas, or, you know, is this really the best method of going forward for our planet and for our country?
Buffalo agrees and says future generations must be kept in mind.
So I hope that we can find common ground moving forward and that we can really put the health of the people at the forefront, and also the health of our soil, and the health of our air and the health of our water. And so I hope that we're thinking long term and not just for today.
Haaland's confirmation hearing in the Senate and Energy Natural Resources Committee lasted more than 2 hours and was picked back up Wednesday morning. The nation's first missing and murdered indigenous persons report issued by a U.S. Attorney's Office came out last week. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, comprehensive data is still an issue.
By state Justice Department standards, there are 11 missing and 8 murdered indigenous people connected to Oregon. But multiple sources of such data use different definitions, which can create information gaps. As part of a federal effort to streamline data and develop bonds with tribal communities, the District of Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office will collaborate with the state's 9 federally recognized tribes this year. Cedar Wilkie Gillette is the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Person Coordinator for the district. She says it's a milestone that her office released the report, but is also a call for help in making it more thorough.
This is what our data looks like. We know it's an incomplete picture, and we need help in updating the data and knowing about the cases and assisting and working on them.
Gillette adds the COVID-19 pandemic has curbed her plans to personally visit all tribes in Oregon, but they'll carry on virtually for now.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
If you're a Native American expanding or starting a business, the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can make the business loan you need. Info by emailing dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program. Support by the Sanoski Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands of Shirwitui via Skype. There's a lot of mystery, intrigue, and love dancing across the center stage of the fictional story presented in Even As We Breathe by Cherokee author Annette Sanuk Klepsaddle. We are taken to 1942 to a real place, the Grove Park Inn in North Carolina, where foreign nationals and diplomats are being housed during the time of World War II. Throughout the pages of the book, we follow the author's main Cherokee character, Kauni Sequoia, who uncovers the layers of his family's past, as well as forges his own destiny while being bitten by the love bug. Themes about wanting to leave home, connections to the land, race, imposing labels on society, are all present in the novel. And we'll get a deeper look into the book today on our February Book of the Month, as we connect with the author, who by day is a teacher. And you are invited to join us too. The first 10 people to make it on air with a comment or question today will get a copy of Even As We Breathe, courtesy of Fireside Industries Books, and an imprint of the University Press of Kentucky. Now you can dial in. Our phone lines are open. The number to join us is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us today, from Bryson City, North Carolina, is Annette Sanuk Klepsaddle. She is an award-winning writer, including the Morningstar Award for Creative Writing from the Native American Literature Symposium. And she is also a high school teacher at Swain County High School. And Annette is an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. Our pleasure to have her here. Welcome to Native America Calling, Annette.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And so, Annette, you really take readers on an adventure, and just want to turn it over to you to just set the scene more of where we meet this main character and kind of what's going on in the world.
Sure. So it is the summer of 1942, and as you mentioned, the Grove Park Inn and Resort, which is located in Asheville, North Carolina. So we're in the western part of the state in the Great Smoky Mountains. The Grove Park Inn served as a prison, a holding site for foreign diplomats and foreign nationals during World War II, just one summer in 1942. And so the novel is set partly at that resort in Asheville and then partly in Cherokee, North Carolina, where I'm from, where the Quala boundary is. In 1942, that's about a two-hour drive. And so the main character, Kauni, leaves Cherokee to go work at the Grove Park that summer to figure out what he wants to do with himself, maybe earn a little bit of money for college if he decides to go there. And he's joined by another young woman named Essie from Cherokee, who travels with him to work at the inn as well. She's a little bit more assured of her future plans and does intend to leave the area after that summer. And so some unexpected events occur, and Kauni is eventually accused of being involved in the disappearance of a diplomat's young daughter. And so he has to prove his innocence while he is there. But also he is dealing with discovering the mystery of his own family, his mother died shortly after he was born, and his father died at the really the tail end of World War I, and there's mystery surrounding what had happened to him. So County is dealing with this family saga and mystery, as well as being caught up in what's going on at the Grove Park, and as you mentioned, trying to hash through some feelings toward Essie in the process.
And so we go many places, including both there at the inn as well as into the home of County's family. And so these two spaces, it's really interesting as you go through the book and what happens in each of these different spaces, but yet how they're still very much connected throughout the entire story. And a lot of times when we jump into stories, especially novels, it is a real view into Native lives. And a lot of times contemporary understanding of our Native nations doesn't happen sometimes beyond our Native nations, beyond tribal borders. A lot of times we're a figure in history that's stuck at first contact. And so you're opening up this and also taking us, I think, to a special time, too, where a lot of the elders of our nations today, this is their story when they were young and running around and figuring out the world, too. And so we're going to continue to learn more about this story. But if you would like to join us, too, you can dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And we are giving away 10 copies of the book. You got to make it on air, though, to qualify for one. So go ahead and dial in now. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Annette, go ahead and give us a flavor of the book. And I know there's a part that you're ready to share with our listeners. So go ahead and jump into that.
Sure. So this is from the prologue, and we'll introduce the reader to both County, the protagonist, and also the place, Western North Carolina, specifically Cherokee. About the place, when I take you there or when you find it on your own, just know that what the old folks say is true. This land is ours because of what is buried in the ground, not what words appear on a paper. But also know this, what is buried in the ground isn't always what you think. It's just the beginning. It's the beginning of the story, the beginning of all of us who call ourselves Homo sapiens. Fitting, I guess, that what I found buried, just as I was trying to figure out how to become a man and still be human, was the very thing that threatened to take it all away. Just when I began to see what taking control of my own life might look like, I realized I was not who I thought, and neither was this place. That summer in 1942, when I met her, really met her, before I found myself in a white man's cage and entangled in the barbed wire that destroyed my father, I left the cage of my home in Cherokee, North Carolina. I left these mountains that both hold and suffocate and went to work at the pinnacle of luxury and privilege, Asheville's Grove Park Inn and Resort. I guess I had convinced myself that I could become fortunate by proximity, escape Uncle Bud's tirades and my grandmother Leashy's empty kitchen cabinet just by driving a couple of hours up the road. It sounded good to tell folks I was raising money for college, but the truth was I didn't know what I was doing. I just didn't want to do it there anymore. And if I stayed any longer, I would become rooted so deeply, I might as well have been buried. My plan didn't quite work the way I thought it would. When I got to the resort, I mostly stayed outside, cut the trees, mowed the grass, and helped to dig the holes that would sink signs and posts for barbed wire fences. Music occasionally seeped from the ballroom, but was muted by thick lead-paned windows before one note ever reached the perimeter of the property. That's where I first found the bone. I was on my hands and knees, pitching rocks and digging holes. It was just as the inn, like its music, had become dulled by wartime restrictions and hushed by lead bullets. The prisoners, who were actually diplomats and foreign nationals treated more like guests, weren't really known to me yet. That girl, God bless her soul, had barely even stepped foot on the property, and I was still as free as I ever would be. I squatted there by the fence along the boundary of the Grove Park property and grasped the bone by its middle, pointing both ends upward, studying its curvature, a bent bauble for my idle adolescent hands to fidget with in the absence of a ball stick or a soldier's rifle. I can't recall playing with many toys as a child. That's probably why the bone spoke poetry to me as a young man. It was smooth and porous, its slight C-curved angled in motion, calling to be grasped, used a weapon, at least in some primitive function of strength, like a subhuman scythe, though innately human, maybe even the very core of humanity. And now, as I recall the moment out loud, it was an embarrassing indulgence of make-believe for a 19-year-old. It's all right to laugh. I don't blame you. I'll stop there.
Well, you know what's really interesting, Annette, after reading the book, because you're introduced to the book, you read that prologue, and then you kind of wonder, okay, where's this going to go from here? But after journeying all the way through, hearing you read this again, it's kind of funny of what it really sets us up for and exactly what's about to happen, and especially what we see County go through, as well as some of his inner thoughts. And a lot of the story is first person, and we get to, you know, really get into the head of County and the way he sees the world, the way he reacts to it. So I really appreciate, you know, what you have shared with us today. And for you, Annette, what's one word that you think sums up exactly who County is?
Oh, one word that sums up who County is. I think curious sums up who County is. And I say that because he's certainly at an age where he's naturally curious about where his future might lead, but what life is like outside of Cherokee, and what people are like. And, you know, one of the reasons why I chose for County to be at this age was because it enabled him to still be open to understanding people, not to be jaded too much by some of his experiences with outside communities, but also to be kind of coming into his own and his own power as a young man and establishing, you know, who he really is going to be and stepping into speaking up for himself, for example. So, you know, I think of County in 1942 as being very curious.
He certainly is, and his curiosity really moves the story. We're going to continue our visit with our Book of the Month author. You can join us too. Phone lines are open, 1-800-996-2848. Deb Haaland is facing both praise and criticism on her historic journey to head the U.S. Department of the Interior. We'll get perspective on the confirmation process in the Senate this week and look ahead to the competing expectations she faces in a cabinet position. That's coming up on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling's February Book of the Month. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo. Cherokee author Annette Sanuk Klapsettle is here with us today talking about her new book, Even As We Breathe. And if you'd like to share some thoughts on the story she's presenting, we hope you'll pick up the phone and dial in to 1-800-996-2848. And Annette, you know what? The phone calls are starting to come in. Let's go ahead and check in with folks. We have Jamie, who is at Lac de Flambeau in Wisconsin, tuned in on WOJB. Thanks for giving us a call, Jamie. You're on air.
Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting story. It sounds like it's going to be a good book to read. I look forward to reading the book. Just want to thank the author there for sharing
Well, thanks for reaching out. And we also have another caller, too, coming in from Derek from Pocatello, Idaho, tuned in on KISU. Thanks for giving us a ring, Derek. You're on air.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say there's a comment from the book that the author was reading that the main character had said, you know, if I stayed too longer, I would be rooted into the ground. And I just had to call in because that comment really resonated with me. You know, I think with a lot of the history that we read and a lot of the culture we try to learn from, you know, we have to take some of those stories and some of those ideas and really put them into our own life and how they can relate to us. So that really, really resonated with me. And I thought it was, you know, really inspiring to think that, you know, in some cases that may be true, you know, where even if you're not physically moving, you know, if you stay in place for too long with whatever you're doing, it's negatively impacting you. You got to make a change. So yeah, that one was just really inspiring. So I thought I had to call in. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, we're glad you did, Derek. And Annette, anything you want to tell our callers?
Yeah, no, I appreciate both those comments very much. And the last comment about being rooted, I think it's incredibly important. It comes up in the book in a few different ways to think about culture as this living thing, right? If a culture does not change in some way, and I am in no way saying adapt to another culture, but to change as cultures naturally do, then they cease to exist. So, you know, at the micro level, it's important for my characters to also change and not to be, I think it's, you know, we want to be in some ways rooted or at least, you know, connected to our cultures no matter where we might go in life, but we don't want it to be a way that stops us from other experiences that might influence our own lives. So I appreciate both of those callers. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to another. We have Nathaniel calling in from Eagle Butte, South Dakota on KIPI. Thanks for that. You're on air.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you for taking my call, and I read an excerpt of the book, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more from the author today.
Well, we're glad you dialed in, too. And so, Annette, you know, there's some big themes, and I do want to talk a little bit more, too, about the characters and considering the time that they are in and, you know, this thought to want to see the world. To leave the small town, to leave, you know, native territory and get out there and see some of the other part of the world. Let's put it in context of what people were thinking and you know, just what the world looked like during this time.
Sure. So, you know, where we live, it's rural Appalachia. Even in 2021, we're fairly isolated. But certainly in 1942, you have two communities juxtaposed. You have Asheville, which where the Grove Park Inn is located, is a city. I think I describe it as breathing jazz notes or blue notes. Because Asheville, even at that period of time, was really kind of a center for the arts. You know, folks like Fitzgerald have ties to Asheville. And then if you think about the property itself, the Grove Park, it's a resort that the Obamas have vacationed at. So it's pretty opulent. There's a lot of Art Deco downtown Asheville, very much a city kind of feel. And then if you travel west to Cherokee, this is a time where the roads are dirt. There's log cabin homes which we've always lived in, kind of rooted up in mountain hollers. The tourism industry is starting to kind of take root with travelers interested in outdoors, like national parks and things like that. And so it's a community that's starting to open up to outsiders for tourism and economic purposes, so which also comes with catering to those needs of tourists and what all that entails. But it's still very much very juxtaposed communities in terms of their economies and ways of life. That was important in the story for me as well to show that these places are in very close proximity, and living conditions are very different. But then, because it's 1942 and the war is going on, both communities are feeling the effects of things like rationing that are going on.
And, something, too, that you bring up, and when we talk about war, explain a little bit of the situation and its link to reality of foreign diplomats. Or prisoners of war being kept there during this time period and kind of what people were thinking.
Sure. So one of the things that interests me about this topic to begin with, I had seen an article in the Asheville Citizen Times that had talked just very, very briefly about the Grove Park serving as a prison for these foreign diplomats and foreign nationals. And it immediately, for me, caused me to recall knowledge that internment camps, Japanese internment camps, were set up on some reservations out west. And I thought that that was an interesting commentary on the federal government's view of these lands where many reservations are set up now and what that means about the difference between when land serves as prison and when it doesn't. And then I also, because I tend to carry several things in my head at once and connect them, I was also thinking about, for the Cherokee, how these temporary stockades on our lands were set up as prisons for our people when our citizenship was in question. And so it made a lot of sense to me to think about how do we define citizenship? How do we define belonging? Who does have a right to be on land? And for the United States, we often think romantically about World War II and our involvement in World War II. And certainly, there are many things to be proud of in terms of our involvement in World War II. But it also was a period that highlighted our internal federal policies, specifically in regards to Native peoples. And and I think probably your listeners are familiar with the rates in which Native people serve in our U.S. military and how that that service helped to garner U.S. citizenship during right after this time period, although it does get complex in some areas. But I just felt like, this was a great way to put all of those pieces almost into a cauldron and heat it up to discuss even contemporary questions of citizenship and federal Indian policy.
Wow, there's so much to be explored. Explore it with us, too, by dialing in. You can talk to Annette. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And the name of the book is Even As We Breathe. We're going to give away another copy. Looks like we have plenty left. If you'd like to join us, dial 1-800-996-2848. Let's go ahead and say hi to Michael, who is in Jemez Pueblo, tuned in on KUNM. Thanks for giving us a ring, Michael. You're on air.
Yeah, I do wish you well. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was wondering if anybody approached the author for a movie or even a miniseries. The time period reminds me somewhat of Walton's Mountain, where you could convey what was happening on that side of the United States, because on this side of the United States, you know, we barely had, we still didn't have running water and indoor plumbing usually at that time period. So, and also, you know, the war was a mechanism for us, for our soldiers to come back and bring what they saw of advancement to the reservation. And also after that, you know, we had that people going out and government program relocation. Yeah, the relocation pre-relocation where our people were given the opportunity to find out, you know, what's in the rest of the world and bring it back to the reservation. So, you know, I was wondering about that aspect also.
Okay. And Annette, anything you want to tell Michael?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. I appreciate that. I love hearing all these callers from all over the country. It's really nice to connect with Indian country more broadly. So I would love to talk movie rights or miniseries rights with someone. But, my press and my agent certainly are exploring that avenue. When I write, it is very much a movie in my head, so I would love to see it on the screen one day and be able to share it more broadly because of that. And then, you know, also it was interesting to hear Michael talk about, you know, what's going on out west versus in the east in Indian country during World War II. You know, I will say we also did not have running water necessarily in the homes during that time period, but it's very different conditions out west than with the eastern communities in 1942. And World War II did serve as a catalyst to bring a lot of new opportunities back to the United States in general, and specifically to Indian country. I think it's interesting to hear different perspectives from different tribal communities in terms of World War II, because you're talking about all of these sovereign nations playing a role. And I would love to continue that dialogue. And, you know, there have been some stories from Indian country about World War II, so I'm just happy to add to the mix.
All right. Thank you for that. We now go to Jen in Athens, Texas, tuned in online. Jen, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Thank you so much, Tara, for taking my call. I'm a Cherokee living in East Texas whose family came here from Alabama. And I just wanted to say, being born the same year this book takes place puts me in there right away. Plus, Annette, as an author, you're from the Eastern Band, still living in Appalachia. I like the way you write in the first person and with your flow that keeps me intrigued. I can't wait to read the book.
Thanks for sharing, Jen. And, you know, taking it first person and jumping into a character named County Sequoia, those are probably some pretty big shoes to fill. And talk to me a little bit about the character development and how County came to be. And again, if you have questions or thoughts for Annette, you can dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And looks like we have 5 copies of the book to share with those who make it on air. Annette, go ahead. Your thoughts.
Sure, yeah. I've been asked a lot why I chose a male protagonist, especially a first-person male protagonist. And, it's funny, I never second-guessed that. And I think largely because I think I have taught County in my classes multiple times. He reminds me so much of many of the students that I've taught. He reminds me of friends and relatives when they were that age and, really at the cusp of their future and where they want to go, and they may not necessarily shine in a traditional academic setting like a high school. but you know they're smart. You know they're going to do great things, and it's just exciting to see what happens in the coming years. And so that's one of the reasons, or probably the main reason, why I wanted a young man protagonist. And then also, probably the most influential thing in terms of voice for the novel is I am a huge fan of Ta-Nehisi Coates, and specifically his book Between the World and Me, and the way that he tells that story. It's a memoir, and he has a very specific audience, which is his son that he's relating his life story to. And I teach that book, and so I've read it multiple times, and the voice really sticks out to me. It really sticks with me. And so I wanted my protagonist to have that kind of effect where we feel like we're hearing a story from a family member. And, you know, when I think about the way that we pass on stories or culture within our tribe, It's very much a mentorship. It's a conversation between people. And so I wanted the book to have that similar voice. County is a family name. And then, of course, Sequoia is quite a famous name, especially for the Cherokee people, as the creator of the Cherokee syllabary. So that's certainly an nod to our long legacy of literary culture for our people. So those are the reasons for my protagonist.
And, you know, I'm proud to say that not too long ago, we took a full look at the syllabary and what it means to Cherokees today. You can find that in our archives. You said family, and I think family is a really big element in moving this story. And coming up after the break, Annette, I'd like you to introduce us to some of the other family members and just kind of what they offer or are also opening up in terms of understanding Cherokee culture. If you'd like to join us, we'd like to have you. All you got to do to join the conversation is pick up the phone and dial 1-800-996-2848 is a number. We're also sharing copies of the book, so go ahead, dial in now.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, who have been providing scholarships and other support to Native students of every age for over 30 years. Scholarship applications for the upcoming school year are being accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Application deadline is May 31st.
Thanks for spending your day with us here on Native America Calling. It is our February Book of the Month, and we are in North Carolina right now, connected to Annette Sanuk-Clapsaddle. She is an award-winning writer, and she joins us today as our featured artist, author. And Annette is an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. Even As We Breathe is the book that we are hearing about today, and if you want to hear more, go ahead and dial in 1-800-996-2848. We're giving away copies of the book. There are five left, so dial now. And so, Annette, the family, tell us a little bit about more of the characters that we get to meet and really understand what our main character's family is all about and what it means to them.
Yeah, sure. So, as I mentioned, both of County's parents passed away really when he was just an infant. And so County was raised by his grandmother Leishi and his uncle Bud. So in terms of Bud, he has a really complicated relationship with him. There's a lot of hostility between the two. Bud is detached from County in many ways. He has extremely high expectations of County's work ethic and whatnot. And County also has an issue with his foot that causes him to walk with a limp. It's one of the reasons why he's not serving in the military at that time. And Bud, who is a veteran, makes comments as if, you know, he holds that against County and expects twice as much from him in terms of work if he's not going to serve in the military. So there's a lot of animosity between the two early on. County works his way through understanding that better as the book develops. Lishi is a completely opposite character in that she is an incredibly nurturing grandmother figure. And I actually, this is one of the places where I play with labels a little bit, because the word Lishi in Cherokee refers to a maternal grandmother. And, of course, we have a matrilineal society, and so mothers and grandmothers and aunts play a very important role in child rearing and raising in our community and in other ways as well. But Lishi in the book, with a capital L, as if that is her name, is County's paternal grandmother. And so I wanted to indicate that it's not always maybe these dictionary definitions of relationships that matter, but more so the roles that we play in each other's life. So Lishi has raised County and has fulfilled that traditional Cherokee Lishi role in County's life. So she, you know, earns this title, this name. And she encourages him in his academic pursuits. She considers herself a very Christian woman in what she says, and going to church, even though she will fall asleep in church, and things like that. So she's kind of an interesting character that's very much reflective of many of the Cherokee grandmothers I know in our community or knew growing up. She is in some ways reserved and lets County make his own mistakes, but she also is there for him when she needs, or when he needs her, and is very funny, has a sense of humor that's quiet, and another thing that's very familiar for the Cherokee grandmothers of our community, who have their inside jokes that are always surrounding us. So those are the two main family members that County interacts with throughout the novel, and help him to not only discover his family mysteries, even though they've kind of taken part in concealing some of that, but also in helping him to discover who he is going to be without telling him who he's going to be.
You know, I got to let the other animal out of the bag. There's a monkey in here, and I had to ask you about that. And does that have any ties to something that actually happened in your life? Tell me more, Annette. Again, if you want to join us, 1-800-996-2848.
Yeah, Edgar the monkey. One of my favorite characters. Edgar actually is based on a real monkey that used to roam around the Smoky Mountains and scare the living tar, as we say, out of people in the woods, like hunters in the woods. He'd show up, and as you can imagine, seeing a monkey in the woods is a little frightening. So there's a storyteller from a local community that has told this story about a monkey being in the woods, but I kind of redeveloped this monkey and named him. And he serves an important purpose for me in that I'm using him to mirror another animal from more the Cherokee world, which is a bear. There are a couple of mentions of bears in the book. And so Edgar belongs to a Cherokee, or not belongs, Edgar is affiliated with a Cherokee man named Zodzi, who has rescued Edgar from a carnival that came through. And there is some allusion to why he was rescued, because Zodzi, the Cherokee man who did it, is reflecting on his own family's stories about the stockades and being held prisoner. And then for us in Cherokee culture, bears are extremely important. They are the animal that most closely resembles humans. In fact, there is we have seven clans today, but there are stories that there was another clan, the Bear Clan, who were as close to human as you can be, and so that in turn means that, you know, we have certain ritual and cultural and ceremonial practices involved with things like bear hunting. So, in the book, I wanted to make the connection subtly that, you know, in Western culture, those who believe in things like evolution see the primate as our closest scientifically related animal. And then in Cherokee, we see the bear. And sometimes there is this stereotype that comes through in literature that Native people commune with nature and can talk to animals, and it's this thing you can do because you're Indian. And I wanted to push back on that a little bit and say, you know, it's, you know, science believes that we are related to primates. How is that any different than holding a respect for our relationship to bears? And so I use those two animals to juxtapose those two different cultures and to say that it's not some kind of magical property that we have as being Native. It's just realizing our connection to place and our, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years of protecting this place and knowing how to live within this place. And I think anybody that does that understands our, you know, their nature and their environment a little bit better.
Wow, that's a lot of fun in it. I'm glad you did that. I'm glad you brought it out. I got another caller who would like to say hi to you. We're going to say hi to Shaylin, who is in Sells, Arizona, tuned in on KOHN. Thanks for giving us a ring, Shaylin. You're on air.
Hi. First off, I just want to say thank you, Annette, for what you have put out into the world. I always get inspired excuse me, by Native writers, as I want to become one day as well. And my question was, like, you were able to combine culture within your writing, and I wanted to know what advice you would give to those wanting to do the same, as I'm somewhat struggling with that as well.
Nice. Well, Shaylin, I wish you the best with your writing. Go ahead, Annette.
Yeah, thank you, Shaylin. I think that's something that, you know, I know that speaking with other Native writers, we all kind of struggle with how much you incorporate your culture. And one of the things I struggle with specifically is how much of a history lesson I have to give to readers, assuming that people, for the most part, are really unfamiliar with not just, you know, my own tribe, but, you know, Native communities in general. My job as a fiction writer is not to lecture, it's to write a narrative. So, Shaylin, I would say one of the things that I have just chosen to do is to tell the narrative and to tell it as authentically as I possibly can. I think about, and I've said this to other people who've asked how my book was received, if I can walk into our local grocery store, which is a food line, if I can walk into our local grocery store in Cherokee and not worry that somebody's going to call me out on something I wrote about, then I feel pretty good about it, you know, that I've written an authentic story. They don't, you know, not everybody I live around has to like it, but it has to hold true for them in the sense of this, you know, it does take place in 1942, but am I communicating, you know, our culture and our values and, you know, our landscape in an accurate way? And so when I write, I'm writing the narrative, I'm writing the story, and that those things about our culture are going to be embedded in that. And then I don't worry about the history lesson until I have to, until I have an outside reader who maybe doesn't get something. And then I know where I need to maybe put the cliff notes for non-native readers here and there. But it's always a balance. But I think it comes with knowing who am I writing for. And of course, I would love for my book to be read, you know, all over the world. But first and foremost, it needs to ring true for my own community. And then everything else I can supplement when I edit.
Nice. Yeah, going to town pump and going through the real native gauntlet. Fun. Thank you, Shaylin, for asking. We now go to Tony, who's in Gallup, New Mexico, tuned in on KGLP. Tony, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air. Okay, let's go ahead and see if we can get Tony back. While we do, we're going to say hi to Ann in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, tuned in on KIPI. Ann, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I was listening to the program this afternoon here, and I think that this book sounds like a pretty great book. So I have no questions, just a comment that this is something I think people will enjoy reading. Thank you.
Okay. Good to hear your voice. And let's try Tony again. Tony, thanks for giving us a ring. Go ahead. You're on air.
Yeah, I'm Tony. I was calling from Gallup, and the train was coming by and it made that loud noise, and I couldn't hear you. Anyway, the question I was going to ask, do she plan on writing any new books? And if so, can she just give us a brief outline about what type mm-hmm. of book?
Well, Tony, thanks for asking. Yes, Annette, I hope you're doing more. Anything you want to give folks a head up on?
Sure. What I'm working on right now is another novel, but it is set contemporary period. My biggest question right now is whether or not it's pre or post COVID, because that changes quite a bit. But it is also set in Cherokee, North Carolina. And this time my protagonist is a female Cherokee woman. It's going to sound a little scattered because that's just where I am in the process. But what I'm doing is taking traditional Cherokee stories, specifically origin stories, and not retelling them in a contemporary way, but kind of extracting the values from them and what we are to take away from them and apply them to a contemporary setting where the protagonist is dealing with issues of individuality versus the collective and issues of land. I've been joking a little bit that I might get run off because I'm going to talk a little bit about tribal politics. I may be moving after this one is done, but
or at least shopping somewhere else.
Yeah, I'll go to a different grocery store maybe after this one.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in. We got Gary in Espanola, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Gary, you got to make it quick.
Okay. I'd like to hear more about the ant people in creation, but when I heard there was bears and monkeys in your current book, that's when I knew I had to call in, because those are two of my favorite animal characters, along with Maven Ravenmacher. And Corn Maiden.
Very nice. Well, Gary, thank you for giving us a ring. And Annette, we got to wrap things up here. Of course, where can people connect with more of your work and some of the things that you're thinking about this world?
Sure. So I have a website, asanookclapsaddle.com. I'm also on social media, all the platforms, and you can just Google my name probably and find that. So I'll try to keep in the future things updated on my webpage, though, and my social media posts will have the most up to date in terms of events.
Okay, well, we wish you the best. Thank you for bringing this book to us today, Annette Sanook Clapsaddle. Also, thank you to the University Press of Kentucky for providing books to our callers today. And we hope you will join us again tomorrow as we jump into a discussion on the confirmation hearing of Deb Holland to head up the Department of the Interior. Maybe you have been watching along and have some comments to make. I hope we'll make them tomorrow. Make plans to tune in, share your thoughts. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll meet you here tomorrow here on Native America Calling. And again, if you'd like to hear this program one more time, you can find it in our archives at NativeAmericaCalling.com.
Native America Calling is supported by Oregon State University eCampus. The strength that comes from your tribal community can make all the difference in reaching your goals. Oregon State eCampus is committed to providing another source of strength with a supportive educational community that respects your culture. Earn your degree online, but not on your own. Visit ecampus.oregonstate.edu/Native America Calling.
Jessa Jadalok Desti Hia Jude Tiesa Di. Ita Tigesti Jada Doi Tohigesa Na Iga Udage Di Jeha Guwahidasti. Tatla no Heta Niawia Uyela Nudanadega and Excestiski. Naski Yiged Stella at healthcare.gov ale 1-800-318-2596. Hia Getanosa Medicare Hale Medicaid Unadalka I.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.